Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of
GF Investment Services, LLC
are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Any investments based on Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Well, hello again there, everybody. This is Richard Martin from the Wake Up Call, coming to you from Southeast Asia. And it is Friday, the 15th of May, 2015, and I am very glad to be with you all for the hour. Well, a foreshadow of depression crossed the planet like a total eclipse of the sun twice in the last 100 years. The first time was America's Great Depression. You know that story. Stocks crashed, businesses went broke, people lost their jobs, banks failed. Events were following the typical depression script, which probably would have bottomed out and recovered within a couple of years, as happened in the Depression of 1921. But then the federal government stepped in. It froze prices, including the price of labor. It cut off trade. It blocked liquidations. It arrested the progress of the correction. Murray Rothbard analyzed the policies of the Hoover and Roosevelt administrations in his 1963 classic, America's Great Depression. He showed how government was trying to stop the depression, but actually prevented it from doing its work. The short, quick deflationary shock should have slashed bad debt, bad businesses, and bad investments. But instead, it turned into a long, agonizing slump. The depression should have been over by 1933. But it continued until the 1940s and was only ended then by the biggest public works spending program in history, World War II. This, by the way, didn't actually make people better off economically, but it put people to work and largely disguised the drop in living standards which that war and the depression had caused. The second long depression was in Japan, following the crash of its stock market in 1990. It's now been a quarter of a century since that crash. Japanese GDP has scarcely advanced. It is certainly difficult to argue that Japan is impoverished, as it remains the world's largest creditor nation. However, there can be little doubt that the government's deficit spending and money printing sprees have severely undermined Japan's economy. A reckoning is undoubtedly on its way. From a high of nearly 40,000 in 1990, the Japanese Nikkei stock market index now trades at around 20,000. It has taken 25 years to claw itself back to a 50% loss. The blame for the longevity of the depression can be placed squarely on the government. To this day, it continues to meddle in the economy, essentially forestalling a genuine cleanup of bad debt. Instead of allowing the bad debt to be written off and reduced, policymakers have added more and more debt over the entire 25-year period, so that today, Japanese government is the most indebted in the world. And now, Japan's running out of time and money. Its aging population is no longer saving for retirement. Now, retirees expect to spend those savings. This means that the government can no longer count on financing from Japan's savers. Now it must return their money. But how is it going to do that? It has no money to give them. Like the US, it has been running budget deficits for years. Japan's economy is in a crisis. It's been 2 years since the Shinzo Abe government began its stimulus program. But wages are actually lower today than they were when it began. So-called Abenomics has so far dramatically lowered the living standards of Japan's citizens while inflating the stock market back to only a 50% loss since 1989. This is what Keynesians call success, judging by the fact that they continue to praise Abe's hoary inflationism. And this is happening against a backdrop of falling labor supply. The labor pool is expected to shrink by 20% over the next 25 years. The main goal of the stimulus program was to raise Japan's inflation rate. But you could multiply the last 12 months of price increases by 9 and still not reach the government's 2% target. In the US, too, inflation has been disappearing as fast as good manners. In the last 12-month period, consumer prices were approximately flat. And that's despite a 400% increase in the Fed's assets, the nation's money foundation, over the last 6 years. If that kind of money printing doesn't cause an increase in the CPI, frankly, what would? If inflation can't be counted on to reduce the world's debts, what about deflation? The feds fear it, loathe it, and try to prevent it every way they can. But deflation works. It knocks down sales, prices, and employment, forcing borrowers into bankruptcy. Then their debts are worthless. Alas, in a zero-rate world, the banana peels disappear from the sidewalks. It's almost impossible to go broke, default, or fall on your face. Grant's Interest Rate Observer told the story of one company, Radio Shack. The company lost the plot back in 2007, says Grant's. The Onion satirized its chief executive, Julian Day, putting the following words in his mouth. There must be some business model that enables this company to make money, but I'll be damned if I know what it is. But Radio Shack stayed in business, borrowing ever more money as its credit rating declined from BB- to D, or junk, over the following 8 years. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, this loser of a company that anyone, including me here on the wake-up call, could have predicted with quasi-certainty would go under, played games with the system successfully for 8 long, miserable years. Finally, it bit the dust in February of this year. You see, there's nothing like unlimited cheap credit to keep the wheels turning slowly. In 2009, which was a grim year for American business, 60,837 firms declared bankruptcy. In 2014, there were 26,983 bankruptcies. What's surprising is not that there were so few bankruptcies, but that there were so many. When you can borrow for nothing, or close to nothing, why does anyone ever default? Of course, not all firms have equal access to the free money. The little guys go broke. It's the big guys who stay in business. The economy stays alive, but on life support. The big limitation of this system is that as the slump worsens, prices fall and real interest rates actually go up. That is, the feds may lend at zero, but if prices are falling, the effective real borrowing rate may rise. The authorities would be zero-bound, unable to take nominal interest rates below zero, and unable to keep the real price of money at nothing. According to the central planners, capital is to be priced at zero. These destructive policies will eventually blow up the entire monetary system. Until recently, it had been presumed that rates could not sink below zero. People would not pay for the privilege of holding cash in a bank or a bond. They'd just take the cash and hoard it. But, as I mentioned on Monday in my lead piece, and according to the title of that show, all over the world, central governments have become a war on cash, designed to force people to use credit rather than cash. The feds can monitor, tax, and control credit. They can even force you to pay for the privilege of having it. The European Central Bank and the Swiss National Bank already require depositors to pay for storing money. And beginning last week, J.P. Morgan Chase began charging depositors a utilization fee to hold their money. Meanwhile, economists are advocating taxing cash, or even, like Harvard economics professor Ken Rogoff, making it illegal. France has already made it illegal to pay bills of more than 1,000 euros with cash. And the US requires financial industry workers, such as bank tellers, to rat out customers by filing suspicious activity reports on anyone who comes in with what they consider an inappropriately large amount of cash. So why is there a war on cash? Partly to control you, and partly to control the economy. If they can create a no interest rate policy world with negative nominal interest rates, they may be able to keep the credit flowing to cronies and zombies, maintaining the economy in a coma for many years. Businesses that should go broke will have access to credit. Speculators will still make money. Governments will continue to print money and borrow it from themselves. The zombies will throw rocks and bottles every once in a while, but they will still get their cash, and the system will survive. Remember, this is not necessarily what is going to happen in the future. It's been happening already for several years. The politicians respond to today's capital interests, not tomorrow's. Today's retirees vote. Today's stockholders give campaign contributions. Today's cronies control the power and money of today's society. And all of them fear one thing more than any other: the future. They all know they will die and that the process of capitalism is creative destruction. Today's wealth owners must be stripped of their money and power so that tomorrow's generations can take over. And that's why government's essential role is to look into the future and try to prevent it from happening. This is just another way of saying that governments will always try to stop depressions, because depressions are creative destruction in action. Capitalism chops down today's trees so that tomorrow's saplings can get some air and light. But trying to stop creative destruction doesn't stop the future. It just changes it. Instead of a dynamic, honest, and growing economy, we get stagnation, economic gangrene, and financial rigor mortis. Long depressions, in other words. The end result of economic gangrene and financial rigor mortis is that by continually preventing creative destruction from taking place, the authorities ensure that nothing will grow anymore. Instead, the comatose economy will slowly but surely transmogrify into a desiccated corpse. The governments of the so-called free world look at the future and try to prevent it from happening. As we have seen, Japan has already had a 25-year slump. The US is now in year 8 of its slump, with fragile growth at only half the rate of the last century. Negative rates could keep the cronies in business. The slump itself, combined with peak debt and 500 million Chinese laborers, could keep inflation in check. But you see, the point comes when investors see that the risk of loss is greater than the hope of gain, because something can always go wrong. That moment must be approaching in the U.S. stock market. Prices are near record highs, even as the economy flirts with recession. Jacking up the stock market has been the Fed's singular success. The U.S. Fed of 1930 was not nearly as ambitious and assertive as the Fed of 2015. In the 30s, it watched as the economy chilled into a Great Depression. As Ben Bernanke arrogantly and stupidly told Milton Friedman, "We won't do that again." It couldn't if it wanted to. Back in the 30s, consumer debt had barely been invented. Most people still lived on or near farms where they could take care of themselves even if the economy was in a depression. Few people had credit. Instead, they had savings. There were no food stamps, no zombie industries, no cash-back mortgages. There was no disability, no rent assistance, no student debt. And cash was real money backed by gold. Look, ladies and gentlemen, I guarantee I'm the first one ever to have said this to you, but it has to be said, and clearly and succinctly, so that you cannot misunderstand me. Compared with today, they had it good in the 1930s. Sorry, but the Depression just wasn't the horror that awaits us now. Virtually no debt, people living right where the food was, locally administered health care for almost nothing in terms of what they knew then, no mortgage agony, no car loans or student loans. Today, the coming long depression in the United States will be unbearable. The public won't be able to stand it. 6 out of 10 households live paycheck to paycheck. Can you imagine what's going to happen when those paychecks cease? Supposedly, the U.S. economy is growing, with the stock market near record highs. Yet 1 out of every 5 households in America doesn't have a single wage earner. Among inner-city black men aged 20 to 24, only 4 out of 10 have jobs. Half the households in the U.S. count on government. What'll happen to the cities and suburbs in a real depression? Well, ladies and gentlemen, as I'm sure you're all aware by now, legislation giving U.S. President Barack Obama authority to speed trade deals through Congress failed a crucial procedural test on Tuesday, delaying a measure that may be key to Obama's diplomatic pivot to Asia. In a setback to the White House trade agenda of PPP, the Senate voted 52 to 45, 8 votes short of the necessary 60, to clear the way for debate on the legislation, which would allow a quick decision on granting the president so-called fast-track authority to move trade deals quickly through Congress. The vote marked a big victory for Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid, an outspoken opponent of fast-track. The vote at 52-45, effectively delays fast-track legislation Obama wants to expedite approval of trade accords. Supporters needed 60 votes to advance the bill to a final vote. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said the Democrats' opposition was pretty shocking and vowed to keep working to reach an agreement he could bring back for a vote later. Note that the subtext is that Obama might find a way to surmount this procedural hurdle. However, 8 votes is a large margin to overcome, particularly since Obama had been making a full court press. Moreover, the stance of many of the opponents is entirely reasonable. Show us the bill! And Obama knows it will not withstand scrutiny. I wouldn't be surprised if we see another effort to get fast track passed, particularly since some senators like Ron Wyden have made it clear they are amenable to a deal. However, such a visible defeat is a big boost to the opponents. Obama has already resorted to shameless lies to try to rally support for the bill. It will be instructive to see what he tries next. Well, please call your senators and representatives and tell them that this vote today was proof of deep-seated opposition to both the president's refusal to allow proper review of such important legislation and how dangerous they are to American citizens from what we can infer from the sections that have been leaked. This fight is not over until it's over, and it's important to keep pressing after gaining ground. This is really bad for Obama. The administration had a ministerial meeting set for the end of the month for TPP with the hope of resolving open issues. The other countries are not willing to make their offer until the Americans have secured fast track. So this is an embarrassment internationally and wrecks the planned timetable. Some senators had been willing to approve fast track if the Senate would also pass an amendment that closed a loophole in existing legislation that allowed goods to be imported that used child or forced labor. Another part of the deal that the senators had wanted was much tougher requirements on designating foreign countries as currency manipulators. Apparently, what happened today was that the administration tried getting a vote on fast track only. And the senators that were willing to go along if they got child labor and currency manipulator protections passed rebelled. This is bad for Obama on every level. While the administration could, in theory, revive the deal by giving in on the child labor and currency manipulator issue, Obama may actually not be willing to concede this point. This finally marks a big victory for Elizabeth Warren, who was the most visible face of this campaign, and who the administration attacked personally. Okay, well, let's take an email from Hugh Thomas, who says, "Dear Richard, now I think you understand my awful poem about the grim reaper. His shadow is over every one of your email reports. If my recollection is correct, you mentioned the possibility of government rules limiting bank account withdrawals. I could see a new industry whereby lenders could offer loans against your own locked savings towards when withdrawal rules are relaxed. No business like business. The scope and detail of your new show format is breathtaking. I have replayed installments for a number of people. Although having licked my chops in Pavlovian anticipation at your old intro music on the PRN stream, I don't miss it. Your diving into the alarming facts now is enough. Although at my age, the day's end shadow is getting a bit longer, the grim economic, political, and cultural news outdarkens the prospect of my natural fate. I came of age accepting the certainty of progress. I think I've grown up. With thanks and regards, Hugh." Hugh, that's a very profound email. I really am incredibly impressed and grateful and awed that you should have considered me for airing such profound views. Thank you, and thank you again. Well, now for a grandfatherly tap on the shoulder, courtesy of your team of one at the wake-up call, this time directed at the student class of 2015. So please wake up, kiddos, and pay attention to what I have to say. Dear class of 2015, because we recognize your plight, allow us to provide you with a bit of friendly advice as it relates to your student loans. Once you are unceremoniously thrown from your dorm into the less than robust US jobs market, you will likely discover that contrary to what you were told in your economics courses, the US economy is but a shadow of its former self. Because you probably didn't study to become a petroleum engineer, you will likely find your student debt burden to be quite onerous. The key to having it discharged is to make just enough money to stay clear of bankruptcy, but not enough really to survive above the poverty line. This is because it's hard to have student debt discharged in the event you go completely broke. However, if your discretionary income is so small as to render you incapable of making payments, the government will start you on a program whereby a monthly payment of $0 counts towards the 300 so-called payments you need to make to have your debt forgiven. Toe this line carefully, i.e. don't slip up and start making too much discretionary income. And the entirety of your student debt will be forgiven in 25 short years without your ever having to pay a dime. So there you are, some friendly advice. And all for the asking. And of course, the listening to the wake-up call. Well, under the Republic of Ancient Rome, to be a citizen was an unparalleled status that people throughout the entire known world aspired to achieve. Roman citizens were granted very special privileges and benefits. The right to vote, the right to stand for election, the right to engage in commerce. They had the right to settle disputes in an impartial court. Roman citizens were even exempt from the death penalty, except in cases of treason, where they were still afforded a fair trial. But citizenship is ultimately a contract. And like all contracts, citizenship has both costs and benefits. It also changes over time as the stronger party sets aside or reinterprets parts of the contract. As the Roman Republic descended into imperial chaos, the costs of citizenship began to outweigh the benefits, many of which disappeared altogether. Elections became obviously rigged, and bribery was rampant. So the right to vote wasn't exactly much of a benefit. Cicero tells us in 54 BC that so much money had been borrowed to rig Roman elections that interest rates had temporarily doubled. By the 4th century, Romans were being executed simply for violating Emperor Diocletian's infamous wage and price controls. And in addition to the rapidly deteriorating benefits, the cost of Roman citizenship was constantly increasing through higher taxes and a devalued currency. We find the same trend unfolding today in the land of the free. U.S. citizenship obviously still carries significant benefits, but for many people, the costs are already far too high and the benefits are disappearing quickly. Elections have become entertaining formalities where the highest offices are passed around among political dynasties. The right to engage in commerce has been smothered by an army of bureaucrats and regulators. U.S. citizens are being body scanned, spied upon, and in extreme cases, even assassinated by drone strike. And their once prized civil liberties have become a punchline of the police state. This is tough to stomach. Sure, the U.S. is still a nice place to be. It's generally clean, safe, and well-developed. But it's more often gut-wrenching to live in a once-great nation in terminal decline than it is to deal with the inconveniences of a less-developed country on the rise. Panama is a great example. It's a middle-income country full of great opportunity and growth. It's clearly a nation on the rise, and a very nice place to be. Greece might technically have a higher GDP per capita and more developed infrastructure, but the trend between each of these two places is pretty obvious. In Panama, there are still many growing pains, as with any developing country, but there's an overwhelming sense of optimism. Panamanians know where they're going. Forward. Higher, better, Conversely, it's viscerally painful to be trapped in a former paradise, stricken with terminal corruption and bureaucracy, and to feel like there's nothing you can do about it. And here's what's so important, not only to understand, but to absorb and internalize completely within you, ladies and gentlemen. There is nothing you can do about your government. You can't bail out the US government, or the Japanese government, or the French government, or anyone else. You don't owe it to yourself, or your government, or anyone else to stay put. These trends are unfolding. It's happening. Free countries are becoming less free. And rich countries are going broke. But what you can control is what happens to you. We all have a breaking point where the costs of citizenship outweigh the benefits. And when people reach their breaking points, they deal with the situation in different ways. Some express their frustration through violence, as we've seen recently in Baltimore, a classic. From their governments. Last quarter, in fact, 1,333 people in the land of the free renounced their U.S. citizenship. This was a record number, again. But these aren't the only options. Violence and renunciation may seem extreme, but they're not exclusive. Today, all the tools and resources exist to take back your freedom, reduce the costs, and reclaim the benefits without having to resort to extremes. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, Greece had a €750 million payment due to the IMF 3 days ago. They made it by writing a check to the IMF funded by special drawing rights, or SDRs, which is nothing else other than, wait for it, funds held at the IMF. It works like this. Participating nations deposit money into the IMF's SDR fund to be aggregated so the IMF can make loans. What Greece effectively did was take back their IMF SDR deposit in order to pay the IMF. If what you take from this is that they took $20 out of one pocket and put it in the other, and by so doing claimed to have paid the $20, you're right. Yes, we're into the realm of the insane, ladies and gentlemen. This sort of crap is the same thing that governments do all the time when they spend in deficit and give the money out in social programs. They claim that the funds help the people, but the act of diluting the currency through deficit spending takes the very same value back out at the very same time. In other words, while specific people might be helped, the net economic impact is at best zero and due to inefficiency is factually negative. In Greece's case, it's much worse because the €500 million they moved around has to be replenished within 30 days. They had no means to do it and no expected income to do it with. Unless Europe gives them the last €7.5 billion in their bailout package. But even then, the problem just gets moved, because they have bond redemptions they must fund, and they'll still be sucking on a dry hose. The bottom line remains the same. deficit spending must stop now in order for Greece's budget to stabilize. In fact, they must either default on the debt or run a big enough surplus to service and retire it. Well, this last alternative appears to be flatly impossible, so that makes default the only rational act. But irrespective of default or not, the deficit spending must stop right here, right now. And this is actually no different from what you face in the United States, with one exception. The back of the United States is not quite yet up against the wall, as is the case for the government of Greece, but it will be soon. Well, here's one more piece of anecdotal evidence that the end of these crazy bubbles is near. Picasso's Women of Algiers smashed another auction record. Two artworks topped $100 million each at Christie's sale. The Picasso painting sold for $179.4 million and also set an auction record. The record for paintings was joined by a record for a sculpture, when Alberto Giacometti's Pointing Man was purchased by an anonymous bidder for $141.3 million. This is yet another piece of evidence that the top is here, that we're in the midst of a huge bubble that is destined to collapse. Well, you're likely thinking that a discussion of sound banking will be a bit boring. Well, banking should be boring. And we're sure officials at central banks all over the world today, many of whom have trouble sleeping, wish it were. Well, what I'm going to do here to end the show is explain why the world's banking system is unsound and what differentiates a sound from an unsound bank. I suspect not one person in 1,000 actually understands the difference. As a result, the world's economy is now based on unsound banks dealing in unsound currencies. Both have degenerated considerably from their origins. Modern banking emerged from the goldsmithing trade of the Middle Ages. Being a goldsmith required a working inventory of precious metal, and managing that inventory profitably required expertise in buying and selling metal and storing it securely. Those capacities segued easily into the business of lending and borrowing gold, which is to say the business of lending and borrowing money. Most people today are only dimly aware that until the early 1930s, gold coins were used in everyday commerce by the general public. In addition, gold backed most national currencies at a fixed rate of convertibility. Banks were just another business, nothing special. They were distinguished from other enterprises only by the fact that they stored, lent, and borrowed gold coins, not as a sideline, but as a primary business. Bankers had become goldsmiths without the hammers. Bank deposits, until quite recently, fell strictly into two classes, depending on the preference of the depositor and the terms offered by banks: time deposits and demand deposits. Although the distinction between them has been lost in recent years, respecting the difference is a critical element of sound banking practice. With a time deposit, a savings account in essence, a customer contracts to leave his money with the banker for a specified period. In return, he receives a specified fee or interest for his risk, for his inconvenience, and as consideration for allowing the banker the use of the depositor's money. The banker, secure in knowing he has a specific amount of gold for a specific amount of time, is able to lend it. He'll do so at an interest rate high enough to cover expenses, including the interest promised to the depositor, fund a loan loss reserve, and if all goes according to plan, make a profit. A time deposit entails a commitment by both parties. The depositor is locked in until the due date. How could a sound banker promise to give a time depositor his money back on demand and without penalty when he's planning to lend it out? In the business of accepting time deposits, a banker is a dealer in credit, acting as an intermediary between lenders and borrowers. To avoid loss, bankers customarily preferred to lend on productive assets, whose earnings offered assurance that the borrower could cover the interest as it came due. And they were willing to lend only a fraction of the value of a pledged asset to ensure a margin of safety for the principal, and only for a limited time, such as against the harvest of a crop or the sale of an inventory. And finally, only to people of known good character, the first line of defense against fraud. Long-term loans were the province of bond syndicators. Demand deposits were so called because, unlike time deposits, they were payable to the customer on demand. These are the basis of checking accounts. The banker doesn't pay interest on the money because he supposedly never has the use of it. To the contrary, he necessarily charged the depositor a fee for assuming the responsibility of keeping the money safe, available for immediate withdrawal, and administering the transfer of the money if the depositor so chooses, either by writing the check or passing along a warehouse receipt that represents the gold on deposit. An honest banker should no more lend out demand deposit money than Allied Van and Storage should lend out the furniture you've paid it to store. The warehouse receipts for gold were called bank notes. When a government issued them, they were called currency. Gold bullion, gold coinage, banknotes, and currency together constituted the society's supply of transaction media. But its amount was strictly limited by the amount of gold actually available to people. Sound principles of banking are identical to sound principles of warehousing any kind of merchandise, whether it's autos, potatoes, or books, or money. There's nothing mysterious about sound banking. But banking all over the world has been fundamentally unsound since government-sponsored central banks came to dominate the financial system. Central banks are a linchpin of today's world financial system. By purchasing government debt, banks can allow the state, for a while, to finance its activities without taxation. On the surface, this appears to be a free lunch. But it's actually quite pernicious and is the engine of currency debasement. Central banks may seem like a permanent part of the cosmic landscape, but in fact, they are a recent invention. The U.S. Federal Reserve, for instance, didn't exist before 1913. Fraud can creep into any business. A banker, seeing other people's gold sitting idle in his vault, might think, what's the point of taking gold out of the ground from a mine, only to put it back into the ground in a vault? People are writing checks against it and using his banknotes. But the gold itself seldom moves. A restless banker might conclude that even though it might be a fraud on depositors, depending on exactly what the bank has promised them, he could easily create lots more banknotes and lend them out and keep 100% of the interest for himself. Left solely to their own devices, some bankers would try that. But most The occasional chastisement of imprudent bankers and their foolish customers was an excuse to get government into the banking business. As has happened in so many cases, an occasional and local problem was solved by making it systemic and housing it in a national institution. It's loosely analogous to the way the government handles the problem of forest fires. Extinguishing them quickly provides an immediate and visible benefit. But if the delayed and forgotten consequence of doing so is that it allows decades of deadwood to accumulate. Now, when a fire starts, it could be a once-in-a-century conflagration. Banking all over the world now operates on a fractional reserve system. In our earlier example, our sound banker kept a 100% reserve against demand deposits. He held 1 ounce of gold in his vault for every 1 ounce banknote he issued. And he could only lend the proceeds of time deposits, not demand deposits. A fractional reserve system can't work in a free market. It has to be legislated. And it can't work where banknotes are redeemable in a commodity such as gold. The banknotes have to be legal tender or strictly paper money that can be created by fiat. The fractional reserve system is why banking is more profitable than normal business. In any industry, rich average returns attract competition, which reduces returns. A banker can lend out a dollar which a businessman might use to buy a widget. When that seller of the widget redeposits the dollar, a banker can lend it out at interest again. The good news for the banker is that his earnings are compounded several times over. The fractional reserve system is why banking is more profitable than normal business. In any industry, rich average returns attract competition, which reduces returns. A banker can lend out a dollar, which a businessman might use to buy a widget. When that seller of the widget redeposits the dollar, a banker can lend it out at interest again. The good news for the banker is that his earnings are compounded several times over. The bad news is that because of the pyramided leverage, a default can cascade. In each country, the central bank periodically changes the percentage reserve, theoretically from 100 down to 0% of deposits, that banks must keep with it according to how the bureaucrats in charge perceive the state of the economy. In any event, in the US and actually most everywhere in the world, protection against runs on banks isn't provided by sound practices, but by laws. In 1934, to restore confidence in commercial banks, the U.S. government instituted the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or FDIC, deposit insurance in the amount of $2,500 per depositor per bank, eventually raising coverage to today's $250,000. In Europe, 100,000 euros is the amount guaranteed by the state. FDIC insurance covers about $9.3 trillion of deposits, but the institution has assets of only $25 billion. That's less than 1 cent on the dollar. I'll be surprised if the FDIC doesn't go bust and need to be recapitalized by the government. That money, many billions, will likely be created out of thin air by selling Treasury debt to the Fed. The fractional reserve banking system, with all of its unfortunate attributes, is critical to the world's financial system as it is currently structured. You can plan your life around the fact that the world's governments and central banks will do everything they can to maintain confidence in the financial system. To do so, they must prevent a deflation at all costs. And to do that, they will continue printing up more dollars, pounds, euros, yen, and what have you. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's it for our show today. As always, a pleasure talking to you. Have a wonderful weekend. I will be back with you, as always, on Monday. Until then, this is Richard Martin saying bye-bye.